I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. The residential real estate company Redfin estimated that 2.7 million renters nationwide faced eviction in 2015. Here in Philadelphia, one in seven renters faced eviction in 2014 and 2015. That's about 41,000 people. More than half of all renters in the U.S. pay more than 30% of their income on rent, and many low-income renters pay closer to half of their income and more on rent. There are a number of reasons for eviction: the lack of affordable housing, stagnant wages, a high rate of poverty, rising housing prices, all seen here in Philadelphia. Being evicted can have serious consequences, making it harder to get a Section 8 voucher, increasing the risk of homelessness and unemployment. Adding to the problem, tenants rarely have an attorney to represent them in eviction cases when most landlords do have legal representation. Today on Radio Times, what you need to know about tenant-landlord disputes. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can always send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me introduce our two guests. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Rashida Phillips. She's managing attorney of the Landlord-Tenant Housing Unit at Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, representing low-income Philadelphia tenants. It's been about 10 years. And Rashida Phillips, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Corin J. Wise. He's managing attorney at the Philadelphia law firm of Corin Wise Attorneys at Law, and he has represented landlords. And Corin J. Wise, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Rashida, let me begin with you, but Corin, I'd like to have you weigh in. And I just want to put a couple of, I guess, facts and figures on the table. What is the typical cost of rent in Philadelphia? And I realize it depends on whether you're living in Society Hill or you're living up in Brewerytown or living up in the Northeast. But do you know that, Rashida?
Right. So from what I'm understanding is that the average price of a rental is rising. There was a time when it was about, on average, about $750. From what I understand, it's on average about $1,200 for a comparable property. So that's my understanding in terms of the cost of
rising rents. A typical average
yes.
rent here, obviously
right.
with some variation.
Exactly.
Corin, does that make sense to you?
On average, I would guess that's correct. I know I come across rentals available for $500, $600 a month that are always on the market for houses, multi-bedroom houses.
What I'm curious to you, Rashida, what is the typical or perhaps the acceptable rate of income to rent?
So for a person who's considered low income, generally we think that they should be paying no more than 30% of their income towards rent and household expenses.
And if the average rent is about $1,200, is that generally true in Philadelphia?
So, no, it's not generally true. I think in Philadelphia, what we're seeing is that people are paying up to and more than, in some cases, 50% of their income towards rent. And especially if you have higher rental averages, then you're going to be paying more of your income towards that rent if your income hasn't changed in that time. And also just accounting for things like inflation, people's incomes don't always match, you know, when everything else inflates. Right. So, yes, I would say people are paying more than the average, than what is generally considered acceptable, particularly for low-income people. And I think for all people in general, it's
sure.
also, you know, we don't want people paying more than 50% of their income towards rent, whether you're low income or not. It just doesn't make practical economic sense.
Does that make practical economic sense to you, Corin?
Sure. I mean, living expenses are a significant budget in any household. Low income folks, I would assume there are cases in which people are paying more than 30%, of course.
Corin, what are the various reasons from a landlord's perspective for evicting someone? Why and how does someone get evicted in Philadelphia?
Number one reason is non-payment of rent or habitual lateness of rent. But there could also be breaches of the terms of the lease, such as additional people living in the property or pets. They run the gamut, obviously, damage to the property, nuisance violations, criminal activity. There's any number of reasons a landlord would send a notice and proceed with eviction proceedings.
And how does that proceed?
Sure. First is a notice to vacate required by the Landlord-Tenant Act. That would give notice to vacate the premises based and state the infraction, whether it's non-payment of rent and the amount owed or a breach of a term. Then if they don't vacate the premises, then an eviction proceeding would be filed in Landlord-Tenant Court, Municipal Court, 13th and Chestnut. Mm-hmm. And then typically logistics from that point, once you file a complaint in the municipal court, typically you would get a court date within 4 to 5 weeks, I think is what the courts are running at this point. And that court date would be an opportunity for parties to appear. There's always opportunity to mediate the dispute where you could discuss payment arrangements or remedy any issues at the property, come to some agreement. Hearings are often rescheduled to later dates if there's conflicts. But if there's no agreement, ultimately it goes before a municipal court judge who hears the case and renders a decision.
Rashida, from a tenant perspective, and Corin talked about non-payment or late payment. From a tenant's perspective, what are some of the cases that you have dealt with that's a different perspective than what we got from Corin?
Sure. Sometimes what's deemed non-payment of rent may be a tenant exercising their right to withhold. In a lot of these cases, what we see is that, you know, there may be, you know, and granted, there may be cases where it's just straight up they haven't paid their rent. But in a lot of situations, they're living in substandard conditions or housing conditions that are such that they're exercising their right to not pay rent because the law allows them to do that. And the law says that if your landlord is not, if there's open L&I violations, for instance, or if your landlord is not being responsive in terms of taking care of repairs that the landlord is responsible for under the lease, that the tenant has the right to exercise withholding their rent. So in a lot of cases, tenants may be doing that and, you know, they've given a certain type of notice to their landlord. Maybe it's oral notice, maybe it's over a text message, maybe it's an email that they're going to withhold their rent. But if the landlord disagrees with that mm-hmm. perspective, if the landlord says, you know, I'm going to move forward anyway and file something in court, if there's no open L&I violations, for instance, to go along with them withholding their rent, the landlord may still be able to proceed with filing in court. So in a lot of cases, we're seeing that people are actually withholding their rent because they're living in conditions that are such that they don't want, you know, they shouldn't have to pay their rent for living under those conditions.
And what kind of conditions are we talking about?
So we're talking about leaky roofs. We're talking about basements that are flooding with sewage. We're talking about broken windows. We're not even getting to like lead paint issues, mold issues, all sorts of living conditions that people are living in. There was an article that came out recently that talked about hundreds of uninhabitable properties in Philadelphia that people are living in. We're seeing a high amount of default judgments, for example, in places in like Kensington, where there's a high rate of L&I, open license and inspections violations. And so there is a correlation between people being taken to landlord-tenant court and people having substandard housing issues. So we're seeing a lot of that. We're also seeing people who are in situations of domestic violence, for instance, who may be caught up in the court system or in the landlord-tenant court system who are simply trying to get out of their property. So there's all sorts of backstories where it's not just a clear-cut non-payment of rent. Again, some cases there are,
right.
Definitely.
I hear you.
And you know, that's tied to economics, that's tied to the high rate of poverty in a city, that's tied to a lot of different things, but, it is what it is. They owe rent. The landlord's entitled to take them to court. But again, there's these other issues that come along with it. There's these other nuances that contribute to why people are withholding their rent or not paying rent and legally are able to do so.
Let me pick up on something you mentioned. And this was something that was in the Philadelphia Inquirer in the Daily News. And Corin, I'll give you a chance to respond to this. And I'm quoting here an Inquirer Daily News review of 507 properties deemed, quote, unfit for human habitation between January 2016 and the end of May this year showed 180 had rental licenses, 30 more had vacant property licenses, the rest had no licenses. According to a Philadelphia code, a landlord without a rental license has no right to collect rent. How common, how serious a problem do you think this is?
It's definitely a serious problem when a property is uninhabitable, whether it's deemed uninhabitable by the L&I or whether it has serious habitability issues. If we're talking about they're not being heated in the property come wintertime, that's serious. If there's, Ms. Phillips mentioned flooding of sewage in the basement, that's serious stuff. And that does rise to the level of habitability. To your point about housing license is, well, people would argue about the benefit of the housing license system. The housing license that is required from by landlords, you stated the code to collect rent if they don't have one. Landlords have to go to the municipal service building and pay $50 per unit, and they can obtain a housing license. There's no actual inspection of the property at the L&I level at that point.
Right.
So whether they have a license or don't have a license doesn't reflect necessarily on the condition of the home. But if a landlord, if a property is uninhabitable and a landlord is not addressing that, that is obviously a breach of the lease and covenant of habitability, and the tenant needs to address that with the landlord or definitely get out of there. That's a serious situation, and no one should have to live with those infractions.
Well, let me toss this back to you, Rashida. You both mentioned L&I, licenses and inspection. Are they the monitor? I mean, before you get to the court system, are they the government agency to monitor this rental situation?
Yeah, essentially in some regards. But as Corinne mentioned, you know, there's not proactive inspections. The housing inspection license is sort of a misnomer in that there's no inspection sort of involved. You can get it. The only thing that sort of
prevents... So no one comes out to look at what it is
right.
that you are renting.
Exactly. And the only thing that sort of prevents you from being able to get it is if you have open license and inspection violations. And you know, we're a large city. There's a lot of rental properties out here. And at this point in time, L&I is just not able to manage being able to do proactive inspections up front to prevent a landlord from getting their license if they do have issues that haven't been accounted for in
the
system.
So does it fall on the tenant, essentially, to
Yes. It becomes the tenant's responsibility to call L&I to sort of be able to protect themselves from retaliation if they need to, for instance, file a complaint with the Fair Housing Commission. There's a process that they can go through to do that. But again, a lot
it's
of this relies on
–
it's very
it?
Complicated. It relies on the tenant having a lot of knowledge, having a lot of ability to move around and call different people, go to different offices, keep track of different things, plus dealing with whatever issue they're dealing with in the unit. So it requires a lot. It does.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about tenant-landlord disputes, how and why evictions occur, and what can be done to represent both sides of this. And talking with Rashida Phillips, she's managing attorney in the landlord-tenant housing unit. This is at Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. Corin Wise, managing attorney at Corin Wise Attorneys at Law, also here in Philadelphia. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We want your questions, your comments, and your stories. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moskowing. I'm talking with Rashida Phillips and Corin Wise about tenant-landlord conflicts, what you need to know about eviction. And we have Kevin, who called us from Ben Salem. Kevin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning. Morning. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems that I have with being a renter is that your landlord or any other management company, they don't give tenants enough time to pay the rent. The 3 to 5 day grace period is just simply not enough when you're on a shoestring budget, and more should be done. More time should be given. Is that something that you can agree with me about?
Well, you know, Kevin, how much time do you think would be fairer?
You know, maybe two weeks at the absolute max. Anything after that, then, you know, maybe they should take action. But, you know, 3 to 5 days is just absolutely not enough.
Well, let me see what Corin Wise has to say. Kevin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Corin, does he have a point?
It's an interesting point. I hadn't heard it before. Tenants will typically, if they have an issue coming up with the rent, should be proactive with the landlord and say, here's my situation, here's what I can do. As far as providing a grace period of 2 weeks it becomes just logistically difficult for landlords who also have bills to pay, and mortgage companies don't give you 2 weeks, for example. So it's not necessarily the landlord's decision that rent needs to be due the first of every month and the 5-day grace period, because there's other people on the other end that are looking for the landlord to pay them with that money. So it is an interesting idea.
Yeah, it is. However, Rashida, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think both everybody makes a fair point. You know, I think in a private housing context, it's a little bit different and a little bit more difficult because there are certain bills that landlords have to pay and that come up. I think in a subsidized housing arena, we see a little bit more leeway with tenants. I think there is a bit more of a structure there for if a tenant is late with their rent to be able to talk with your building manager or request a hearing, a process that occurs before it gets to the point of having to go towards eviction. So I think there's some happy medium in between there, especially when we're talking about low-income tenants who are often on fixed budgets. Some people get SSI and they only get it a certain time of the month, and so they can't have that money, you know, the first of the month, and it requires them to sort of be able to save money ahead of time in order to make the rent the next month. But again, I get it. I get the landlord's point. I think there's a happy medium somewhere. And I think we can also do well to remember that lease agreements are essentially contracts. So you can negotiate, you know, you can sort of negotiate that time with the landlord if that is something that you think is important to have in your lease agreement. But, you know, in a lot of these cases, the landlord has the upper hand in terms of the bargaining power. And so tenants don't feel that they have the ability to have those discussions and make those provisions in their lease.
Let me talk about the fact that last year about 24,000 landlord-tenant cases were filed in court. And Corn was talking about how that process works. And Corn, I'll get you back in on this as well, but from the tenant perspective, one of the things that we learned in putting the show together is that largely tenants are not represented. They represent themselves. How does that put them in a vulnerable category?
Well, that's correct. So we have found through research that about 81% of landlords get representation on average, while about only 5 to 8% of tenants get representation. And that number is even lower if you account for low income tenants. So we're saying that they're only getting about 1 to 2% of representation out of those 24,000 eviction filings. I mean, the process is intimidating at best, regardless of if you have a lawyer or don't have a lawyer. It's an intimidating and scary process. We're talking about losing your home, losing the roof over your head, your kids being on the streets, all of these things. And so the process, I mean, as Corinne described it, it's pretty much the process. But the thing I would note is that in terms of the notice period before the landlord has the ability to go to court, in private lease agreements, you can waive that notice. So a lot of leases do waive the notice. The state allows you to waive the notice. So a lot of tenants actually don't get notice through that process if they're in private leases, because their lease agreement may have waived the landlord having to give them notice. So that's one set. But even if you do get a notice, it's still a lot of people do not know their legal rights. So they don't understand that notice is essentially acts as a warning. Your landlord still has to take you to court in order to evict you legally. But a lot of people think when they get that notice that they have to leave as soon as they get that notice within the time period that it says. No, your landlord still has to take you to court, and you may have some options in between the time that happens. But a lot of people don't understand that and don't realize that. And in some cases, you actually may want to leave when you get that notice because you don't want to get that stain on your record of the landlord filing, which is a whole other
issue. Oh, I didn't
even
think about that.
Yeah, so then when you get into the court, if you don't have representation, it's a crazy process for people. It's, you know, you get in there, there's 100 people sitting there. You don't really have any guidance about what you're supposed to do, where you're supposed to sit. You're sort of, you know, so the process in and of itself. And then it's very easy to get a default judgment if you don't show up at the dot at 9 o'clock on the dot. You know, the court is located in Center City. We have a lot of people coming from different areas of the city that may have to catch several buses. They may be disabled. They may have to drop their kids off to school. So a lot of cases actually end up in defaults. I would say last time we looked, it was about 30% of the list each week ends in a default judgment where people are, you know, they didn't show up in court for whatever reason.
And that gets on their quote-unquote record?
Yeah, and they can be evicted essentially within 21 days if they don't go and try to open that judgment up, the way the process moves. And there's usually more time, but you could be evicted within 21 days if you don't show up in court. If you do show up in court, what happens, again, most tenants don't have a lawyer. The other side typically will have a lawyer. And so you're talking directly with the landlord's attorney in most cases. Now, there is a mediation process if both parties are unrepresented. But in most cases, again, the landlord is represented, the tenant's not. So the tenant's dealing directly with the landlord's attorney who, and again, that's a very intimidating process for a low-income person who isn't aware of what their legal rights are.
Corinne, can you understand how a low-income person, as Rashida said, let's say she or he is negotiating with you, that's going to be an intimidating process?
Of course. Anytime you have to show up in court, it's nerve-wracking, even for attorneys. As someone who's being evicted, we're dealing with their housing. That's very serious, especially if you have a family and other concerns in life. Mm-hmm. But I will say the judges go to length to hear the litigants and the pro se tenants. They do have to get themselves to court. They do have to go through the mediation with the lawyer. But folks that are heard by the judges have a chance to get themselves heard and tell their story. At the end of the day, it is a contractual relationship that we're dealing with when we talk about leases. So, and historically, tenants are in a disadvantaged position when it comes to negotiating with a landlord. But there are a lot of protections in place to try to level the playing field. I think people would argue that these protections do level the playing field to some extent for the vast majority.
But you have to know your rights. I mean, you have to know your rights in order to be able to, I guess, access that information.
And when we talk about attorneys, I know there's several attorneys that I personally know that do reach out to tenants. As soon as a case is filed, they'll probably get a contact letter from an attorney before they're even served with a complaint, offering to represent them in court at very low cost, extremely low cost. So the majority of the defendants, the tenants that are being sued, will get contacted by an attorney as soon as that suit hits the court, and they can have an attorney represent them for a very affordable rate.
Well, we have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me just add that City Council has earmarked something like $500,000 to help renters with either counseling or legal assistance. And Rashida, I'm assuming that's something that you support.
Yes, definitely.
Let me just read a question here, an email from Imad, who says, my question, how long the eviction record stays, especially for a first-time eviction? You had mentioned this earlier, Rashida.
Yeah, so the eviction can go on two different records. There is a sort of landlord background check that is exclusive to landlords where the filing may show up on that database, but it also can show up on the credit, especially if there's a judgment. So it can stay on that credit for several years unless and until you dispute it if it's incorrect. But what happens also with an eviction filing is that it's a matter of public record. And so that eviction filing, even the fact that it was filed, regardless of if you won, regardless of if it's vacated, the fact that it was filed alone still shows up in the municipal court database. And so anybody can access that database and find out information about the tenant and use that as a basis to, whether rightfully or not rightfully, use that as a basis to deny a future housing to a future tenant.
Even if it turns out that they were correct?
Exactly.
The fact that it's there. Corinne, does that make sense to you?
Sure. An eviction, we're talking about a court proceeding. This is a legal case filed in the municipal court in Philadelphia, and anybody that would search the dockets or do a judgment search in Philadelphia County would see that when we say eviction, it appears as a judgment just like any other judgment against somebody. So that would appear on their record. When we say, well, even if they were right, if they won the case, anybody looking at the judgment would, and Rashida is correct that even if it's filed, it's going to show up on the dockets, but anybody that is interested in knowing what that was about or what happened, they would be able to find the judgment and see if it says judgment in favor of defendant, then they won. So it depending on who's looking or why they're looking, that should be informative for them.
Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I would just add a lot of landlords will just look at the filing alone and make a judgment based on the filing, and a lot of landlords do not go the extra mile to look and see what actually what the outcome was. You know, that's just the experience of tenants that we hear coming through our offices.
Let me get Rachel from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I recently purchased a property at an auction. It was on an online auction, and it was a property that had been recently foreclosed upon and went to sheriff's sale, and I had to wait for the sheriff's deed to be recorded, so it took a while.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally was given access to the property, I found that the previous owner was still living there. And I have met with the previous owner. I have offered this person money to hand over the keys and vacate the property. She told me she didn't have any money to find another apartment, so I offered to sign a lease with her so she could continue to live there for a very reasonable amount, but she said that she really can't even afford that. She told me that I should probably start eviction proceedings, which I feel terrible about doing, but I purchased this property as an investment in order to rent it out, so I do want to move forward with that. I guess my question is, what are my rights and responsibilities to this person while they're still staying there and not paying me any rent? And also, should I go through a standard eviction proceeding? And if so, how long should I expect that to take?
That's a fascinating question, Rachel. Let me start with you, Corin Wise, and then Rashida Phillips. I'll give you a chance to respond as well. Corin, what do you think she should do?
Sure. This is a situation I hear about a lot where someone picks up a property, investment property at an auction, Rachel mentioned an auction site, but they also have sheriff sales that people buy properties and find that folks are still occupying the property. This brings us to a legal concept known as possession, which is a very powerful legal right. It's your right to occupy your land. And if you, when we talk about leases and evictions, that's a contract that a landlord is agreeing to relinquish their right of possession, their right to occupy that land, to live there, to someone else. And that lease says, I'm giving you that right to live there in exchange for rent. Rachel finds herself in a different situation because she doesn't have an agreement with this person. She tried to sign a lease, but for whatever reason, that person said she didn't want to. So she has a person in her house that she owns now in possession, and that right, that person is in possession, and the only way to get possession back of that property is to go through legal process. However, the landlord-tenant court isn't appropriate because there's no lease. Landlord-tenant court is a court of specific jurisdiction covering landlords and tenants. Rachel's not a landlord. She doesn't have a lease. So there's a process known as ejectment, which some people may have heard about. Ejectment is where you eject someone from possession of your property where there is no lease. That could be a squatter. That could be a relative. This is a common situation where it's actually the foreclosed upon prior owner of the property. It's a longer process. It's a more expensive process. It's in the Court of Common Pleas, which is our low-level trial court, a trial-level court, I should say. And filing ejectment requires a drafting of a complaint, filing fees, service upon the defendant. The defendant has 30 days to respond to the complaint. It could be listed for a trial up to 8 or 10 months down the road. And if she gets a judgment, when she gets a judgment, she has the right of possession. It's just the legal process that she has to go through that holds her up and extends this out several months. She should get a writ that states from the court by a judge that the sheriff can execute her writ of possession and schedule a lockout of that person. I'm told that the sheriff has some procedures that they require when you're actually putting out someone from a sheriff's sale. I don't know about foreclosure or an auction sale. But
sounds complicated. Sounds like should get a lawyer to help walk through all of that. Rachel, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and good luck with that situation as well. Let me just toss something else, and Rashida, I'll put it to you. Some cities, New York City, had or has rent control. I'm thinking about the fact that there are neighborhoods in Philadelphia where they are being either gentrified or you're seeing rents and even the cost of housing going up. How much can a landlord increase someone's rent and thereby, in a sense, forcing an eviction?
So we don't have in Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania any sort of rent control laws. So essentially, a landlord can increase the rent as much as they want. There's no cap currently as in terms of how much the landlord can increase the rent. So they could, you know, go from $750 to $1,200 if they wanted to. The only requirement here, we do have a law that says that they have to provide a certain amount of notice to the tenant if they do want to increase the rent but before the end of the lease agreement and before they increase the rent, to give the tenant an opportunity to say, you know, either I want to stay and try to pay the increased rent or I'm going to move. Mm-hmm. So that, but other than that, we don't have any protections against that.
But do we need more low-income housing in Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whether it's Section 8 or however you define it.
Definitely. We're seeing a loss, and we're going to continue to see losses of affordable housing and low-income housing. The burden, to some extent, is going to fall back onto the private market because there just is not enough affordable housing through HUD programs and through other subsidized housing programs to provide to all the people who need it.
And I'm curious, Corm, do you think landlords are interested in low-income housing?
It comes in many different types and flavors. Landlords do take part in Section 8 and housing choice voucher programs. So as a landlord, if there's an opportunity to run a business and be able to make money with property as an investment, that's what landlords are looking for. So any programs that afford that opportunity, I think they'd be interested in, of course.
We are talking about tenant-landlord relationship, conflicts, disputes, also what you need to know about eviction. And that's Corin J. Wise. He's a managing attorney at Corin Wise Attorneys at Law, a law firm here in Philadelphia, has represented landlords, and with us as well is Rashida Phillips. She's managing attorney of the Landlord-Tenant Housing Unit at Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, and she's represented many low-income tenants in court here in Philadelphia. And again, you can join our conversation, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about tenant-landlord conflicts. They are not uncommon. Rising housing costs, stagnant wages, a high rate of poverty can exacerbate the problem, something that's happening here in Philadelphia. Many poor, low-income renters pay half or more of their income on shelter, and of course, that makes eviction even that much more likely. Talking with Rashida Phillips and Corin Wise, let me get Rodney from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Rodney, go ahead. You're on the air.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had an experience that leads to a question and a couple of instances where I've been filed for eviction against as a tenant. It seemed that the landlord added multiple layers of eviction causes. When I got to court, the only thing they asked for was possession because of the 30-day clause and month-to-month leases. However, because of the nature of my lease, they could not evict, but the judge in both cases ruled against me. And on appeal, they overturned it. So it seems that some of the judges are biased toward landlords, in my experience.
Well, Rodney, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rashida, do you want to respond? Obviously, none of us were in the court with Rodney, but that's his perspective.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's the perspective of a lot of tenants. I think what gets complicated for people is that if you're in a subsidized housing program or you have a lease agreement, there may be certain clauses that apply to your program that don't apply to other programs. So there are certain types of subsidized housing programs where there is this provision called good cause or just cause eviction. And what that provision says is that you can't just evict for anything. You would have to you're only able to evict for an express certain amount of reasons, and in any notice that you provide to the tenant, you have to very expressly lay out why you're evicting that tenant. So that's required in certain leases. If the judges don't know that or don't sort of learn what the different provisions of each program are and understand that when a tenant's in front of them, a lot of things get lost in translation. And so, yes, we see that happen very commonly, that, you know, a tenant's a part of a particular program that provides a provision that or a protection that says you can only be evicted for a certain amount of reasons, but that eviction goes forward anyway because the person, you know, the judge or at the hearing, that fact wasn't teased out and the tenant didn't know to assert that, you know, for various reasons. So,
Corn, anything you want to add to that? And I have a question for you. From your perspective, what should be done to reduce the number of, if not evictions, certainly these conflicts between tenants and landlords?
Sure. I advise landlords and tenants that I come in contact with to just really have honest conversations, especially at the beginning of tenancies. Landlords will be best served to go over leases with tenants, highlight what's important, clarify the terms, clarify the procedures and what's expected, and tenant, you know, can definitely take part in that process and explain what's important to them and what they expect from the landlord. I think that goes a long, long way to building a rapport and creating a relationship. You know, we can talk. There's a lot of evictions. You've named the stats. I think most relationships end successfully, and we don't necessarily hear about every case that didn't go to court. But you know, landlords and tenants, since we are, none of these issues are black and white, I think we all understand that, and we are dealing with folks' housing and their homes and families and very significant issues, so it's important stuff that people should spend the time and take seriously on both sides of the aisle, of course.
Absolutely. Rashida, is there any way to know about the connection between eviction and homelessness in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I mean, I think many studies have shown that eviction is one of the leading causes of homelessness in Philadelphia and in the United States in general. I think, you know, if we can do a survey of the homelessness population and the folks who are in homeless shelters, we'll see that a lot of these situations are connected directly to evictions. You know, there's a lot of people that we can't account for who are out there sleeping on people's couches and hopping from house to house who haven't been checked into any system. But who have been evicted. And on top of that, we have illegal evictions that do not go through the municipal court process. And so there's no way to even account for that number necessarily.
An illegal eviction is what, just dragging someone out of an apartment?
It shows up in many forms. So an illegal eviction is forcing a tenant out without going through that eviction process that Corinne laid out for us. And that takes on many forms. That's turning off the tenant utilities and forcing them out in that way. We've seen people take off the door, you know, change the locks. That's obviously the most common way that it happens. But there's also laws and protections for that. So if a landlord does do an illegal eviction, we have an ordinance here in Philadelphia that says that's not allowable, that they can call the police, that they can get back into the property. But again, a lot of tenants do not know that. Right. And then if you have other issues that you're dealing with, you're an immigrant, you're LGBTQ, you have low literacy level, you just, again, are not going to, the laws are only as good as your ability to take advantage of them and to know that they're out there. And so a lot of people do not know that these protections are in place. And so, again, they end up in the streets. They end up in homeless shelters.
Let me read a couple of comments here. A tweet from Jonathan. He says, you can't be a real estate investor without sufficient capital to carry through these non-income producing events. And I guess that's just from a kind of business sense. An email from Matt, I've observed college students are often no more aware of good strategies than other renters, often not reporting even serious problems in a documentable way, or thinking they can simply withhold rent when, at least in my understanding, is that notice must be given, money must be withheld, and that money must be placed in escrow. So you can be a college student and still not know what your rights are. Yes. Let me get, looks like Catherine from Westchester to join our conversation. Catherine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for covering this topic.
Oh,
It's imperative to our entire community. Mm-hmm. I work in homeless services in Chester County, and we certainly see the impact of eviction on creating homelessness. We have a shelter for families who are experiencing homelessness, but we also have a homeless prevention program, and what I'm seeing is that social services is the one element that needs to be brought into this. We find a great partnership between our legal services, landlords, and our program where we step in, stop evictions, then work with families up to 18 months, get them back on their feet. What we find is this wins over landlords. Our goal is always to make sure the landlord ends up whole in all of our situations. It then leads to housing opportunities for other people experiencing homelessness, even if they have an eviction on their record. And I just want to throw out there that the social service system has a role to play in really stopping this and making sure that families and individuals can maintain safe, stable housing.
And Catherine, is this strictly in Westchester?
We cover all of Chester County.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Well, let me get a response from both of her, I guess. I'll start with you, Corinne Wise. I mean, it seems like a smart thing to do to get social services involved.
Sure. At the top of the hour, we heard statistics and people paying 50% of their income, and those people are probably in low-income properties where landlords aren't necessarily spending as much as possible to keep them in great shape. So there's a incongruency there, and social services might be able to fill that gap.
Yeah. Rashida, you want to add to
that? Yeah, I agree. I really don't have much to add, except, again, that a lot of the people, I think, you know, just to emphasize that the deadbeat tenant is more a rarity than it is, you know, the rule. You know, most tenants want to pay their rent. They want to be able to stay in their units. They want to have stability. They want to work with their landlords. They're not, you know, there are many barriers that cause them to not be able to do that, whether it's, you know, on a landlord's end or it's on their own end and their own capacities to be able to deal with these issues. So I think social services has a huge role to play, especially when we think about how housing connects people to other opportunities, how it connects them to employment, how it connects them to education, and all of these various other systems that need to come together to be able to work. And so I think social services has a huge role in bringing all of those things together.
And I'm also thinking even beyond an individual, let's say family or individual, looking at a community as a whole, the effect of eviction, Rashida, on a neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, loss of affordable housing, it affects entire communities. It's not something that is just exclusive to the individual who's being evicted. You know, and preserving economic diversity is really important for communities. So, again, it does destabilize communities and it causes, you know, blight in certain areas. It just causes instability for everyone. It's not just, again, limited to the tenant itself. So,
Corin, anything you want to add to that?
Not at all.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get Kenny. Catherine, thanks for the call. Kenny now calling us from Bear, Delaware. Hi, Kenny. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I have not signed a rental agreement or a lease agreement since December of 2014. So I wanted to know, as a tenant, what are my rights if I wanted to move or if I needed any repairs done to my apartment that I had?
So you're in an apartment, you've been there for a couple of years, and you've never signed a lease agreement. Is that what you're saying, Kenny?
Right. I haven't signed one since 2014. So I just wanted to know if I wanted to move out or if I wanted to, you know, have repairs done, you know, what rights would I have as a tenant to do that?
Oh, that's interesting. Rashida, you want to take
that? Yeah, so it's really going to depend on what's in your lease agreement. It's not something I can sort of say over the phone because it would depend on, you know, when your lease term ends, whether or not it renews automatically, whether or not the landlord has to provide notice before it renews. So all of these different factors depend. I would advise you to go to TURN, which is Tenant Union Representative Network. They have a website. They have daily workshops and classes for tenants where they can help tenants walk through their lease and understand what's in their lease agreement and what their rights are. You can also visit phillytenant.org, which is a website that is run by several tenant advocate organizations here in Philadelphia, and it has a bunch of self-help information and advice on there. So.
And Corin, I'm thinking about, you know, how many of us have, you know, we sign these legal documents and we don't read them or we don't understand them. Is how important, thinking about our caller there, how important is it just to read your lease so you know what your rights are?
Pretty important.
Yeah, I think so.
That's the first place to start, and people call our office with lots of questions, and I tell them just what Ms. Phillips told the caller, which is, I don't know what your lease says, so I have to see that first before I can answer your questions. But any lease worth its salt would have, it's required to have the term. So the term is a duration. Is it a one-year lease? Is it a month-to-month lease? So a caller would want to see that to find when this lease expired. Then there would be a renewal term, possibly, that would either say, this lease terminates at the end of the term, and if still in possession, would continue month to month, or it might say it automatically renews for another year. And then there would all his question also went to what his rights would be if he wanted to move out. So that he's asking about notice, termination of the term. So sometimes a lease would state you can if you're within the term of the lease, you have to give landlords 60 days to terminate and pay a termination fee, possibly. Or maybe it's silent on that point, and if it did go month-to-month, typically the common law provides that if you're in a month-to-month lease, you have to provide at least 30 days' notice when you want to move out. But take a look at the lease and start
there. See what you got. Kenny, thanks for the call to Radio Times. An email from Jim. He says, I'm happy to give any tenant an extra 2 weeks to pay rent as long as the security deposit covers 45 days of rent instead of just 30. Tenants who have money when they move in but not sure they'll always have rent on time should considering offering a higher security deposit. I hadn't thought about that. Does that in any way, Rashida, make sense to you? I mean, especially if we're talking about low-income renters, you're not going to have a lot of disposable
practically
income.
Practically speaking, a lot of tenants are not able to do that, especially Section 8 voucher tenants and other folks who are part of subsidized housing programs. Typically, it's difficult for them to get even that first month's rent up. But again, in those programs, there tends to be a little bit more leeway in terms of being able to pay your income unless you're dealing with a private landlord who may not give you that leeway. So, I think it's going to come down to the individual and what they're able to do. The law does talk about security deposits and what's the max amount that you can charge someone for a security deposit. Right. And, you know, there's things that govern that. But, practically speaking, it's complicated for tenants. I think even for a tenant who does have, you know, income, it's difficult to get more than 3 months or 2 months security deposit down.
Corin, we've been focusing largely on Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area. Would you say what's happening here related to landlord-tenant disputes is common in other cities, or maybe worse, or maybe better?
I would expect that these issues are prevalent in some, if not all, metropolitan areas. To what extent, I'm not sure. And the response is what's interesting to me when I think about other cities, large cities and small cities, how the cities and the governments deal with these issues, because they're real issues, they're social issues, and there's lots of different ways to deal with them.
Do you think things could be improved here in Philadelphia?
I think there's a lot of interplay between lots of different agencies on these issues that we've talked about that, like I said, aren't black and white issues. They're sensitive issues, and you have you have great resources like CLS with Ms. Phillips and other offices. You have L&I that's involved to some extent, but is obviously very overworked and overtaxed, so not necessarily able to step into every situation. You have the municipal court and the judges and the mediators and the lawyers. So there's lots of people that are coming to bear on these issues. And when you have lots of people coming into a situation, sometimes they work well together, sometimes they don't work well together. So communication is key. Understanding and compassion.
Rashida, I'm giving you the last word here.
Yeah,
what improve the situation?
I totally agree, and I think we're starting to see a culture shift, especially with this commitment from City Council towards increasing representation. We're starting to become a city of more renters. Before, we were a city of homeowners. It was more than 52% of homeowners in Philadelphia. Now it's getting to be about even, and so I think it's time, if we haven't before, to really make renting and tenants' rights and things like that and landlord-tenant relationships a prominent feature of our advocacy work here in the city. And I see that culture happening. I see tenants' rights and this issue being more and more a part of the conversation and tenants having a seat at the table. I totally agree with Corinne. I think as a community, landlords and tenants, attorneys for the most part, we're cordial. We try to work our best together and the judges do their best. Everybody does their best, but we can do better. And I think we're moving towards trying to do better.
Rashida Phillips, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Managing attorney of the Landlord-Tenant Housing Unit at Community Legal Services of Philadelphia. Corin Wise, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Managing attorney at Corin Wise Attorneys at Law here in Philadelphia. Lots of interest in this topic. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.